Hey guys, we got a great interview today with Armin Shimerman. I also want to remind you to check out our I Just Want to Talk About Star Trek Facebook page, where people asked Armin questions in advance and he answered them. So you can check out that. Leave us a 5-star review on iTunes and hit me up on Twitter. And now, Armin Shimerman.
Are you insane?
They are insane!
You're in the hands of an adolescent.
It is a cellular peptide cake.
Inaccurate. But Matt Frosting.
It does like you.
Mr. Kim.
Hi, Christopher. I'm Nero.
How you doing, Mike?
Here's Spock.
Oops. Oh, really?
Okay. Psychonauts 2.
Oh, really? Oh, I love Psychonauts. Were you in the first one?
Mm-hmm.
I played that so long ago, but it was a great game.
Well, I've never played any of the games.
I have clubbed you to death. In a video game.
Oh, in Bioshock?
In Bioshock, yeah. Yes. And I didn't realize that was you until just now. Until like I was like looking up your IMDb and I'm like, oh my God, you played...
Because it doesn't really sound like me. They did something with the bass quality of my
voice. Oh, okay, yeah. But yeah, because I was just like, oh my gosh, because it's... I mean, it was great. It was a great role.
Well, it's a great role, yeah.
And it's a great game.
Yeah, it's a great
game. Although, killing you in the middle of the game is the high point of the game.
I wouldn't know. That's flattering. Thank you very much. I know that when they called me for Bioshock 2, I went, that's not possible. I'm dead. They said no. And then when they called me for Bioshock 3, I went, okay, fine, terrific.
Wait, so you were in Bioshock Infinite, or is it?
I don't know what the names are. I don't know, 2 and 3.
When did you do number 3?
The same, Andrew Ryan. It's all flashbacks or logs or chronicles or from the diary of that sort of thing.
Okay, wait, so when did you do Bioshock 3?
When? I can't tell you when.
Okay, but it wasn't recent. Like,
oh, God, no.
Oh, okay. All right, so that was probably called Bioshock Infinite. Okay, great. You can pull that forward if you want.
No, I'm fine.
Okay. All right, so we just started rolling here, and that's how we roll here. I am here, and I'm Mike McCafferty. My son is sitting close by.
Hello, I'm Kiernan McCafferty.
Unmiked, but still quite loud. And we are here today not to talk about Star Trek, but to talk about The Invisible Man from 2000 to 2001, and a person who played a guest star in a few episodes. So we're just going to kind of dig into that. And this man is Mr. Armin Shimerman.
Hi, Mike. Good to
see
you. Hi,
how are you? We're kidding. This guy was Quark before he was Augustin Gaither on The Invisible Man. Do you remember anything from that
when we did Invisible Man?
Yeah.
Oh my God! Yes, I won some sort of an award for doing Augustin Gaither.
You won an award?
Yeah, some sort of sci-fi award for doing that as a guest star. It was a lovely role. I had a great time. I hated the makeup, but aside from the makeup, it was a wonderful role.
Now wait a minute, So you played Quark all these years, and you hated that makeup.
Yeah, because it was when I saw it, it looks, it's really bad makeup. Whoever the makeup artist, I apologize, but really the work is just not very good. I looked like it looked painted on. It didn't look real at all. It looked like it looked very white, and it was supposed to be white, but it didn't look real white. It just looked like somebody had taken a broad brush and whitewashed me.
I'm glad you said that. It did look pretty terrible. Yeah, I have to be honest with you. I mean, you were great in that role, but when I saw you, so Armin played Augustin Gaither, who was this mad scientist who had blinded and deafened himself, and I don't remember why.
I don't remember why either.
I think it was like self mutilation.
Right. And the only way that he could he couldn't hear, he couldn't see. So he had a box on his chest that sort of processed signals into his mind, and I was constantly wondering, how do I work this thing on my chest?
You had this, I mean, in addition to the makeup being bad, the props were pretty terrible too. I got to be honest with you. I mean, I loved what you did, but when I saw you come rolling out there with the white, you know, like mime makeup and this weird kind of keytar, kind of Radio Shack inspired keyboard, because I guess you're feeling it as well. Like,
right.
they're basing off of Tommy, the
right.
deaf, dumb, and blind kid kind of thing. And it just didn't look good.
No, it didn't.
It was, you had like a weird speaker on
and
your...
And I had contacts as well, so I couldn't really see, because
right.
they made me look blind. And I remember if I walked out from the dark soundstage into the light, truly blinding light because of the context. And but as long as I was inside talking to you, Mike, I was fine.
That is the exact right answer. And actually, Vincent Vitresca had the same problem with those contacts. They were just terrible. I mean, he would walk around and sometimes, because he had to wear them sometimes for hours, and he would get dizzy and he'd have to sit down. But so here I am, big Star Trek fan, and in comes rolling in Armin Shimmerman. And it might have been like the second or third episode where you and I were like locked in this lab for like three straight days.
Right.
And you were probably like, oh, this is terrible. I can't believe this. And I was in heaven. This was so cool for me. And we talked for so long. And I remember at one point in time, you were telling me all these great stories. And at one point in time, you said, Mike, I don't think I've ever told anyone some of these stories.
That's probably true. at this point, I think I probably have told other people. But at that point, yeah, you were probably my best audience. Thank you.
I could not. I was in such heaven on it. And some of those stories, and I admit, I have told a couple of my closest friends them.
Good.
And my wife, who doesn't care one bit about it. Although she did watch the finale of Deep Space Nine. I made her watch those because I was like, these are so good. But they were good. There were some good, juicy things.
We had wonderful writers, wonderful actors, wonderful directors, but primarily our writing crew was phenomenal, and they pushed the envelope as much as they could, and because of that, our episodes still stand up.
I think so, too, and Kiernan, you know, I never pushed him on Star Trek, even though, like, you know, as I was telling you a little bit beforehand, this whole I Just Want to Talk About Star Trek podcast came about because I was going through my midlife crisis, and I had loved Star Trek most of my life, and I said, since it's the 50th anniversary and I'm getting close to turning 50, I'm going to put my life through the lens of Star Trek. Like, did I do right? And so, especially during the 50th, I did all the stuff. I went to the convention. I went to Riverside, Iowa, which is the birthplace of Captain Kirk. Mm-hmm. I marched in the parade. I won the costume contest. I did all these.
Bravo, bravo.
Oh, it was not a hard contest to win. But I kind of cheated because I did like a Kirk monologue and, you know, all these trills and Beta Zeds were upset at me because like, well, that's not a costume. Like, shut up. And they gave me $60. No, like, first place was $60. And like,
more than I get at some convention.
But they said like, well, here's $60. And if you want, you can donate it because we're going to build a statue of Captain Kirk. And if you want to go ahead and donate that's fine. And I didn't do that. I kept it, man. I mean, like,
yeah, absolutely, you should keep it. Ironically, here's a story I'm telling you for the first time, and which is the new Captain Kirk, Chris Pine.
Yes,
grew up a block from me, and his father, Bob Pine, who's a wonderful actor, is a great friend of mine.
Oh wow, okay. He grew up like out here in L.A., right? Because mm-hmm. I was reading that you moved out here when you were like 15. Is that correct?
About right. 15. I can't say for sure 15 or 16. Yeah. That's
okay.
Probably right.
And so you live nearby Bob Pine. Did you know him before?
I didn't. At 15, I wasn't anywhere near Bob Pine. But okay. but where I live now, he and his wife, Gwen, have two children, Chris being one of them. Mm-hmm. And so Chris grew up in the neighborhood where I now live.
Okay. Yeah, there's a little bit of sad news in the respect that Bad Robot, which produces the new Star Trek movies, has announced like six movies they're producing, and none of them are the new Star Trek.
Really?
Yeah, so that series, that franchise may be, especially in the light that Chris Pine is now, you know, launching himself even faster with Wonder Woman, you know, and they couldn't come up with a good payment structure between him, and they wanted to get Chris Hemsworth back for the first one, so... So that franchise may be done.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So thank you for that. I didn't know that.
I don't mind sharing these things with you. Yeah. You know, I mean, I'm here to inform you, Armin.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I live in the dark mostly, so it's okay.
have you seen those movies?
The Chris Pine movies?
Yeah.
Certainly, yeah.
What do you think?
I like them. I love the new characters. I want to see them work more as a team.
Yes.
That is the focus of Star Trek, is working as a team. Mm-hmm. The first one was about introducing the characters and the backstories, and that was lovely. The second one was a little bit more disappointing because I wanted more teamwork. Didn't quite see that. They focused on their stars. Lovely. But I, you know, I spent 7 years actually not being part of the team, but still watching the team work, and I want to see more teamwork.
Wait, so you're saying as Quark,
I was part of the outsider.
You were the outsider. This is true. Yeah. But ultimately, you're a part of the larger
team. Yeah, I'm part of the franchise, certainly. But Star Trek is about a team of Starfleet people and those connected to the Starfleet working in tandem to solve a problem to better the environment that they live in.
Yeah. But you had nothing to do with that.
Rarely. Once in a blue moon, they gave me something to do, but I had nothing to do with that. I was the comic relief. I was the pain in the ass. I was there to poke fun at them when it was needed. And of course, a lot of times after a while, they just gave me my own story, and I was doing what, you know, I was living alone with my brother and my nephew and my nemesis and my mother and doing whatever Ferengi do. Yeah.
But in some ways, like, that became a liberating thing because you weren't tied to that. And you
That's
got
right.
to, and I was, because, you know, Kiernan, we watched the finale, and Deep Space Nine, I think, aside from, I mean, like, Next Generation is all Picard's story. Mm-hmm. You know, it starts out, it ends with him. Voyager is pretty much Janeway's story.
Or Seven of Nine.
Seven of Nine kind of towards the end. You know, she arcs a little bit. The Doctor, maybe. Enterprise is certainly, I'd say, it's Scott Bakula, Captain Archer's. Deep Space Nine has many arcs, and especially with Sisko leaving at the end of the episode, or even before the episode was ending, and just kind of shows up and says, "I'm going to be back," and then he never comes
back. I'm going to be a god. Yeah.
I'm going to be a god. My whole job was to push a guy into a big flaming pit. Mission accomplished.
Right.
I don't get to see my son. That's my reward.
And I think part of that, I don't know for sure. This is all BS that I'm giving you right now, but my frame of mind has always been this, and it's rather self-serving. I think the writers realized fairly quickly that besides the captain, they had a wonderful bunch of actors,
yes.
an incredible caliber of actors on Deep Space Nine, and they decided that instead of focusing on the captain, which had been the format of the previous two shows, that they would give each of us a major episode every 8 weeks, because there were eight of us.
Sure.
And so they did that. Each of us became the lead in our own little, you know, miniseries.
Which, I mean, because it is Deep Space Nine, it's not like, you know, the Federation presents. It is this kind of, you know, diaspora of people coming into this place. It's an old West town, and you're the barkeep.
Right.
And so it is completely apropos to follow your story every once in a while, and to follow Major Kira and follow Odo, because no one's really, I mean, even Bashir has the crazy, you know, I'm a, you know, genetic enhancement from season five on, you know, surprise. but it became such a richer tapestry because of that.
I would hope so. We've been telling people that for 25 years. I don't think they believe us, but it is true. It is a rich tapestry because we are not focused on one or two or three people. We're focused on the whole ensemble. And by that, I mean not just the series regulars, but our guest stars were enormously important as well. You know, Nog, Rom, the people associated with the captain, associated with Kira, all sorts of people, Gul Dukat.
Yes.
All those people, when they appeared, could hold an entire episode. You didn't necessarily need the series regulars. The guest stars and the recurring characters could be the leads in any episode. And sometimes they actually were.
Absolutely. I think Deep Space Nine, and I say this with the most love because I'm a character actor, really leaned heavily into the character actors, the less pretty people of the world.
Yeah.
And they found the richness, because you're right, because I mean, like Garrick or Gul Dukat, yeah. or Damar?
Damar.
Mm-hmm. Jeffrey Combs. Mm,
Jeffrey Combs played all the characters, yeah.
He played all the characters. I met him like 6 months ago, and he's great, but yeah, he plays everything. He's like, oh, I played that too. It was like, all right.
We kept hoping that his two characters would meet. that the Vorta and the Ferengi would meet in some scene and sort of look at each other, but I guess they couldn't afford that. So
they couldn't afford to, like, how would you pay him twice? How does
yeah,
that
you'd
work?
Have to pay him twice
because he's two different characters.
That's right.
That's interesting. And they were like, no, we don't have the budget for that.
They had the budget. They just didn't want to do it.
They always had the budget.
They got it off our backs, if I may say so. Actors were underpaid on that show.
Were they?
Yeah.
Okay. Is there like? Now, is that in reference to TNG and...
Well, the TNG people, I don't want to get into this too much because I'll be treading on very thin ice, but the TNG people also were underpaid when they did the TV show, but I have the feeling, and that's all it is a feeling, they made up for it when they did the movies.
Very possible, very possible. Although, did you hear that, I'll also tell you stuff, because I guess Marina said that they were going to replace her with Seven of Nine in one of the movies.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I don't think Marina would have allowed that.
I don't think she would have either, but that's what they said. And she was like, screw you, as she's tends to say that.
Yeah.
So you feel as though that, but I have to imagine like Voyager and Enterprise was probably somewhat commensurate. Isn't there like a...
I would hope so. I don't know what they got paid. I just have a anecdotal story about the salaries of TNG and how they're connected to the salaries of Deep Space Nine. So I base my assumptions on that anecdotal story. And again, it's anecdotal. It may not be true.
It's fine. You know, I'll share this. When you were working on Invisible Man, it is 100% probable that you got paid more than I did as a series regular. Because
well, guest star, that is set by the union.
And I got paid less than that.
Oh, that's terrible.
I know. Can you believe that?
No.
Like the first year...
No, I can't believe that.
they screwed me over so hard. And I don't mind saying that now. I'm happy saying that. But I basically got paid... I think guest star was $3,500. And I got paid $3,000 plus 10.
Wow. Perfect.
I know. It was so terrible. And the other leads were making huge amounts.
Did you have an agent at the time?
I did, but it was San Diego.
Oh.
But like even the studio head down in San Diego, Stu Siegel, he went to bat for me. He called up the president of the network of USA and said, like, can we get him more money? And they're like, nope. And it's like, okay. So I was undervalued.
I'm so sorry. Because, you know, actors have a period of time when they work, and that period of time has to pay for a lot of time after,
yes.
You know, when there's the downtime. And so residuals and salaries are a little bit inflated. People say, well, those actors make a lot of money. Yes, they do at the time that they're working. But during the period of time when it's a lull, and that can be very long, you're surviving on what you made years ago.
This is absolutely true. Yeah, I don't need anyone to feel bad for me, and I don't need you to feel bad for me.
I don't. I live the same life you do, Mike.
I know you do. I know, but it's just a little better because you get to go to London.
I do get to go to London.
So when I was sitting there with Armin, you painted me this perfect picture of how I wanted to live because you were telling me, because like it was second season Invisible Man, and I knew that if we went third season, we were going to go seven. Because that's that back in the day, that's how it was, right? Like if you like, they wanted to get at least 100 episodes.
Right.
And you're sitting there and you're saying, Mike, I get to go like to Germany, and I get to go I get to go on cruise ships, Mike, and they pay me for this, and it's so great. And you were like my shining idol of what I aspired to, and I was like, oh my gosh,
it's not over yet, Mike.
I know it's not for me. It is, but for you, it's not.
No, for me, you know, I'm 69 years old. It's pretty close to being over.
Oh no. You, I mean, you look great. First of all, you look absolutely the same,
yeah, except for the white hair. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's. I'm turning 50 in like.
You're a baby.
9 days.
You're a baby, Michael.
Thank you. God bless you. I love you. I love you. That's why I want to hear this. That's why I need you here. But it's been a struggle for me. This has been a struggle for me trying to figure out who I am and what I'm doing. But I know no one cares about any of this. But this is what the podcast is about a little bit, for me to figure out who I am. And I've talked to a lot of people from the old series and from, I talked to Robert O'Reilly a little bit about it. And I always say, like, how do you live your life? And you have had this great storied career of like the quintessential character actor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you did so many guest star appearances. I was looking at Hill Street Blues, West Wing. I mean, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, all these great shows. And now you've sort of slid into voiceover for the past like 10, 20 years.
Yes, I've been doing a lot of voiceover because in voiceover, they don't care what you look like.
Exactly. Exactly.
You just have to sound like, I mean, once I, I did an episode of an animated show where I played Superman. That's not possible on camera. but there I was doing it anyway. And yeah, that's the great thing about voiceover. No makeup, no blocking, no memorization, no residuals, really. But it's wonderful work. And usually, if you're not alone in the room and there are other voiceover actors with you, it's a party. It's a big party.
Yeah. I mean, I've done some voiceover, and most of the time it's just like one person. But sometimes I've seen it where it's like, I just did this show, very low budget. I was the writer on this show, and they couldn't afford to have the people come in individually. Mm-hmm. So they had all six crammed into the booth. It's really funny. It's just, and they only had like 2 hours to record it. It's like, this is really
good luck for the director keeping those worms all wrangled.
Yeah. I know. The good thing was, is that they were all professionals, and it was like two takes per scene.
Oh, good for them.
Yeah, they were just like pop, 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 yeah. pop. And they were paid non-union. So, you know, they're all union actors, but it was kind of like, my name today is this, you know, it's anyway, I won't owe any of them, but, talk to me a little bit about, I mean, so you played, did you play anything in Justice League or Justice League Unlimited?
Yeah. I've done one or two villains for Justice League. I'm a Red Lantern, and I can't remember the name of the character. He's a rather globular entity. It looks like a big beach balloon, and he is villainous. Most of my characters are villainous, and I do not remember the name of it. But I recently did another one of those within the past year.
I want to look up if you did anything on Justice League.
Starts with a Z. The character's name starts with a Z, as in zebra.
Okay.
Zilok. I think that's pretty close, actually.
Zilizok.
They're two Z's.
Oh, you played Dr. Achilles Milo.
Yes, I did that for two. I did it for a game, and I also did it for
Justice League Unlimited. Justice League. Yeah, I loved that show. Yeah. That was such a great show. And that was one where you're sitting with everyone, is that correct? Andrea Romano. No.
Yes. In an animated cartoon show like that, they bring you in and you're there with a group of people. Yeah.
Okay. I know that was like five lines out of your life, but it was such a good series. And so I'm not going to just talk about Star Trek.
No, I'm glad.
Even though that's the tenet of
the
show.
It is my worst fear that when I die, the gravestone will say Quark. And I really think of all the things Quark is certainly the crown and glory of my career. Absolutely. No doubt about it. But you're right. I've done other things.
Yes, I know. It's that's how we get kind of
pigeonholed.
Yeah. I mean, I did a role in Idiocracy 10 years ago, and I did a short film where I made $200, and every 6 months it gets posted on Facebook, and people are like, you're so great, Mike, and all I can think of is I worked 12 hours for $200 on that, you know, it's just, and it's fine, but it's weird how the rest of the world sees you sort of frozen in that moment.
That's right.
As you move forward.
Right. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's been 25 years since we started Star Trek, and about 22 years, I would estimate, when I did Buffy. Those are the two things that people always talk about, and I'm flattered that they do. Absolutely. Keep
sure.
It up. But if you go to IMDb, you'll see that, you know, that I've did close to 200 other things, not to mention where my heart is, which is really in the theater, and that's what I'm doing now, actually, and what I've done all my life is theater, and it's when asked, I usually tell this, so it's not a deep dark secret, but I would prefer to do theater over TV or film or cartoons or animation any day of the week.
Now, why is that?
Because you get to sculpt a performance.
Mm-hmm.
On television, which is primarily what I've worked, I've rarely worked on film. You have, as you know, Mike, you have about 20 minutes to rehearse a scene with the other actors who may or may not be doing the characters the way you thought they would do it when you read it on the page. And so you have to adjust to that. And the choices that you make, are rather, you've had the script maybe for 24 hours. And you've made some choices, but then the other actors and the director want you to make other kinds of choices. So you make those instantaneous choices in 20 minutes, and then they shoot it, and there it is for all eternity. Whereas on stage, you have close to a month to rehearse, and even after you open, you're adjusting your performance as you learn more and more about who the character is, what the intentions of the scene are, and it just gets better. So I'm a perfectionist, so theater appeals to me more.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, I can totally see that. I had sort of the opposite. I was started in theater, and I got...
San Diego is a great theater town.
San Diego is a great theater town, absolutely. And I started out, I grew up in Michigan, and I came out there, and San Diego was great, and I was doing, like, professional non-union theater there and having fun. But for me, like, as a younger actor, like, doing 10 weeks or 12 weeks of a show, I just got bored, you know? And so like that, the immediacy of television and film was so exciting to me. And I got into improv as well, which sort of scratched that itch as well. But my son now is going to LOXA.
Oh, wonderful. Congratulations. That's a great school.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm really excited.
So I don't know why I should say that on air, but that's true. And well, no, I mean,
it's fine.
Yeah.
What are you scared of?
Well, I don't know. Someone's going to stop by and say, hey, I know where you go to school.
Oh, Dad.
All right. Well, I have to do that. But so hopefully he will listen to you more than listen to me. He doesn't listen to me at all.
I'm sure he listens to you, Mike.
I'm sure I listen to you, Dad.
Not at all. I played the same role sometimes and have given him pointers. No. But that's okay. That's what kids do. Do you have any kids, Armand?
No children. No. Oh, okay. So congratulations.
Oh, well,
that's
thank you.
That's a great achievement. And I'm sure he listens to you.
Kieran's taking a bow right now. They are wonderful, and they are terrifying reflections of what you are.
Well, sure they are. It's one of the reasons we didn't have them.
Yeah. Now, how long have you been married?
36 years.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
That's amazing.
It is amazing.
What's the secret?
Compromise.
Okay.
Compromise is the secret. And learning to say, as my mother-in-law told me and her daughter, just say yes, dear.
I've learned that. I've been married to Sarah. Sarah was the casting director on the show, Invisible Man. We've been married for 18 years.
Congratulations. That's wonderful.
Thank you. Yeah, we got married like right as the show was starting up. Actually, like the week that it aired was the week we got married.
About the time we met.
It was actually a year earlier, so because it was in 2000 it aired, and I think in 2001 we met.
Okay.
So, all right, so let's see, what else we can also talk about. So we talked about your voiceover stuff, too. I'm just kind of like floating around. Who cares, right?
Yeah, who cares? You know. As long as you ask some theater questions every now and then.
I will.
Or I will insert them, one of the...
Well, you know, I talked to Ellen Gear.
Mm-hmm. I work there. I teach there. I've taught there. I teach a lot. For those of you who aren't familiar, I am a Shakespeare teacher. I teach now at USC. But my teaching career started thanks to Ellen Gear and the Theatricum Botanicum, which is a Shakespeare festival here in Los Angeles out in Topanga Canyon. I hope it still survived. We've had fires, and that's exactly where the fires were. Oof. So I have no idea whether the Theatricum is still there or not, and I hope Ellen's and everybody and all of her neighbors are safe. But Ellen started my teaching career, and that is very important to me.
That's great. So do you find that to be as satisfying?
More satisfying than working on camera anyway.
Okay.
Reason, because, like Kieran, I can pass on what I've learned, and I've learned a great deal about Shakespeare and the performance of Shakespeare, pass it on to next generations and see them get it. And when they get it, I suppose it's a little like being a father. My children glean from me some knowledge and incorporate it into themselves. And that light going off in their minds is one of the great delights in my life.
I've taught a little bit, and I agree that there is certainly, you do have this sort of paternal, you know, instinct with them, and you want to guide them. Do you just teach Shakespeare?
Shakespeare. I've been asked to teach other things, but I don't feel confident or to do that, anything but Shakespeare, and I'm an extremely well-known Shakespeare teacher in Los Angeles.
Okay, what, and you're telling me...
And just to pull it full circle, almost all of the Star Trek actors, almost all of us are classically trained actors.
They have like some sort of Shakespearean training.
Lots of Shakespeare in their background.
I played, you tell me, Jakewees?
Jakewees, sure, Jakewees.
Okay, yeah, because I...
As you like it.
Yeah, from As You Like It, and there was some debate as to how to pronounce it, and there was, you know.
Well, there's a question whether it's Jacques or Jakes. If it's Jakes, then it's a bad blue pun on the name of the character as well as the Elizabethan name for a toilet.
Ah, okay. And you don't feel as though Shakespeare like made that like kind of...
He might have. It depends. There's something called OP, which is old pronunciation. There's a great study of how Elizabethan English sounded back in the late 1500s. And so words that are familiar to us may have been sounded completely different.
Yes.
So maybe Jakes at that time was pronounced Jakes. We have lots of historians who are studying that, but it's always debatable because nobody was around then and there were no tape recorders. So
this is true. This is true. Jakes just sounds a little better. Yes, sounds a little better. You get a little extra syllable there. Yeah. It's like, oh, I played Jakes. What's your favorite Shakespeare monologue?
Monologue, really. I have something from that I've been doing since college. It's from Henry VI, Part 3. The character's name is Richard of Gloucester. You know him as Richard III. And I've done that monologue all my life, and that monologue has reaped me a lot of jobs in the theater.
Oh, okay. Do you want to give us a few lines, or is it...
Sure. Well, say there is no kingdom then for Richard. What other pleasures can the world afford? I'll make my heaven in a lady's lap, and deck my body in gay ornaments, and witch sweet ladies with my words and looks. Well, love forswore me in my mother's womb, and blah, 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 blah.
And blah, 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 blah. Shakespeare, and bow. End of
and
show.
Then bow.
And then bow, and then go receive
yes,
accolades.
Then move on.
That was fabulous. That was great.
Thank you.
And you do it with sort of a standard American dialect?
I do
with,
yes. Again, going back to OP, historians have pretty much proved that the sound of Elizabethan Shakespeare doesn't sound anything like what we're used to. It didn't sound anything like Gielgud or Olivier or even Mark Rylance, who's from America. But rather, it sounded like people from the Ozarks. It was that was the accent of Elizabethan England. So when people ask me about what sort of accent should I use, an English accent? I go, why? And you're an American. If you're an American, make it sound like an American. If you're Japanese, make it sound like someone from Japan. If you're from Australia, make it sound like somebody from Australia. There's no need to replicate a sound that has become de rigueur for English actors. It is touted that they are the best, but I will venture to say that we have Americans, Japanese, Australian, American actors every bit as good as any English actor.
Okay. I will accept that. You know more than I do.
I've had this argument with Patrick many times.
Oh, very good, very good. So, do you have these arguments like backstage, getting ready to go on stage?
Or well,
like,
we're not backstage anymore because we don't work on a sound stage anymore. But I see him at conventions, and
that's what I mean, like backstage at the convention. Yeah. Like, oh, Patrick, yeah. American.
Patrick's very nice about inviting me to lunch or dinner sometimes, and all we ever talk about is Shakespeare. So this is what we talk about.
That's great. That's great. Is there anyone else in that Shakespeare circle that like you would let in? I mean, I'm trying to think.
I'm sure others would be welcome, but usually when Patrick and I have our conversations, it's just the two of us. I don't know why, but that's just the way it is. Sometimes his son Daniel is there.
Yeah. Okay, that's cool. We tried on this show to get Colmini.
Mm-hmm. Good luck.
I know.
It's hard to get Colmini anywhere.
We spent 2 weeks using his voice as we were in the writer's room for this character, and we were so hopeful we'd get him, and we could not.
Cullum, he jets around the world constantly. When we were shooting the show, we were never sure if he was in L.A., if he was in Dublin, if he was in Spain, in Italy. We just never knew where he would be, and if he would show up for the day's work. He almost always did, but sometimes we just had to change days around because Cullum wasn't available. And I have a little night story. I remember taking it, again, it was a convention in London, and I was taking a plane, and Cullen was on the plane. He wasn't going to the convention. He was going back to Ireland, and we were sitting in the lounge. I was in business class. He was in first class, and he left to go to the bathroom or something, and somebody from the lounge came over and said, "Are you a friend of Mr. Meany's?" I said, "Yes, we work together." This is actually when we were working together. And they said, "Oh, we can bump you up, because if you're a friend of Colin Meany's, we can bump you up to first class." So he travels so much that that's a kind of benefits that he gets from flights and travel and that sort of thing.
You told me an alternate story. I thought you were going to tell me about how you guys were going to go through.
Yeah, that happened on the same flight. Yeah,
the customs thing where like he has a secret door that he escapes.
I don't know what he did. This was before 9/11.
Yes,
but we got off the plane. Cullum is a major smoker. It's 11 hours. He hadn't had a smoke in 11 hours, and he turned to my wife and I and said, "You know, come with me." And
come with me.
And he took us through a door, and we traveled through this sort of back door area, past where they were loading on the luggage, not where you find it, but where the guys who carry it from the plane to the. We went through a kitchen. We went down some stairs, and eventually we opened a. He opened a door, and we were out by the taxis on the street. And as you remember, Mike. I was amazed at this and turned to him and said, "Cullum, did we just bypass customs?" And we were in London. And I can't repeat actually on the air what he said to me. It's just a little blue. And I just, although I don't mind being blue in this case, I don't want to put those words in Cullum's mouth.
Okay, fair enough. I think we can all imagine something that he might say. Because he is certainly the salt of the earth.
He is the salt of the earth.
But it's such a great story, and I always remember. I remember so many of those stories you told me. I'm just like, I remember this. I don't remember much about the actual show that I was on, but our like 3 days, like trapped.
Oh, that's very flattering, Michael. Thank you.
I mean, again, here I was, like, a big Star Trek fan all my life. Star Trek, Star Wars, Space 1999, and then here I am on a science fiction show. You know, and it was the greatest experience of my life. And to be honest, I still have a hard time talking about it because it got canceled so dramatically and so painfully. And it was around 9/11, and we had some other, you know, personal stuff that happened that was really rough. And so I, to this day, still have a hard time admitting the fact that I was a series regular on a TV show. You know, but I love talking about how you were on the show.
Oh, that's quite nice. Thank you.
No, it's because it's a great. It was a great moment. So.
You know, I was a huge fan too. I used to make sure I caught every one of the original Star Trek shows on Wednesday nights, and never missed a one. And then I would see them ad infinitum in syndication. And so when I have I told you the story about how I became a Star Trek person?
No.
So, I was a huge fan. I was working on a show called Beauty and the Beast.
Right.
And I was a recurring character, so they didn't have me under contract. And I had an audition for The Wedding Box in an episode of TNG called Haven. Haven. Yeah.
Well, you said The Wedding Box?
I was a character called The Wedding Box. All I was a talking prop.
Oh, right. With blocks on a...
That's right.
Oh, yeah.
Is that you?
Yeah, that's me.
Okay, yeah. Like, y'all painted in gold?
That's right, yeah. That's silver, right. Actually.
Silver, okay.
Brent was painted in gold. So I auditioned for The Wedding Box, and I was excited, just as you're talking, I was excited about auditioning for TNG. At that point, it wasn't on the air, so didn't know what that was about at all. And I got it, and I'm excited I was going to be on a Star Trek, just what you're saying about yourself. And the agent called about a day or two later after they'd called me and booked me on TNG and said, "You're going to have to give this up." And I said, "Why?" And they said, "Because it turns out Beauty and the Beast needs you the same day as TNG needs you." Mm. And your paycheck is from Beauty and the Beast. You're a recurring character there, and you don't want to ruffle their feathers. And I said, "But I want to be on Star Trek." And they said, well, there'll be other opportunities. You'll have to give this up. And I said, no. No, I don't want to give it up. And exactly. And we had a huge argument. My agent and I had a huge argument. But I won that argument. And I went on to do the box in that episode of Haven. And then a couple of episodes later, they were looking for short character actors for Ferengi. And because they had just worked with me on Haven, I was in their minds, mm-hmm. and they brought me in. I auditioned for those original Ferengi, which were execrable performances on my part. And then so I got to do that and did one other Ferengi part on TNG. And then eventually when I was auditioning for Quark, after I'd had my final audition for all the suits and everybody, Berman told me, I said, I sure hope I get this. And he says, I didn't know at that time that I was his first choice. And he said to me after the audition, he said, well, Armin, we wrote this part for you. So it was all because I was a big Star Trek fan and said no to my agent about the Haven episode that this progression of work started.
That's amazing.
It is amazing.
What a great instinct to say, no, I'm going to do.
Yes, it was for a show that no one had ever seen.
Yes.
And people, it's so long ago, people don't remember, but TNG was not expected to be very good. How could it possibly match up to the original show? How could that ever happen? So the bet was that they weren't going to do very well. But because I was a Star Trek fan, I insisted. And in fact, during the first year and a half of Deep Space Nine, all the series regulars would come up to me and say, because they knew I was a fan, and they would say, so Armin, what's a Klingon?
Wow. So you became sort of the touchstone,
yes,
for Deep Space Nine moving forward. That's funny.
And was the first person hired for Deep Space Nine.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting. That's interesting.
That's so cool.
Kieran loves this. We can talk a little bit, because I know they were trying to get Michelle Forbes to play.
Yes. Michelle Forbes was supposed to be a series regular.
Supposed to be Major
and
Kira.
She turned it down.
She turned down, you know this. She turned down series regular on Next Generation, and then Deep Space Nine, and then also Voyager.
That I don't know about Voyager. I did know about the first two, yeah.
From what I understand, they offered her some role in Voyager's, like maybe the Chakotay character or something, mm-hmm. like that. And she turned it three times.
Yeah.
Amazing.
And Denise Crosby, I don't think this is a secret, so I can say it on the air, always regretted leaving the show.
I think that, yeah. It's
because she felt that, as I understand it, Denise, and you'll correct me when I see you next, she felt that she might have had she thought that TNG, again, was not the thing that we know of now.
Yeah.
And she thought that her agents were telling her that she had a film career and that she should give the TV up and stick to a film career.
And at that time, that wasn't a horrible instinct.
No, absolutely not.
Especially doing, because TNG was a syndicated series.
Yes, it was an experiment.
It was an experiment coming out of the box. I remember seeing the trailers for it, like it was on the videotape of Star Trek IV, with that coming soon, Star Trek, The Next Generation. That guy who did like the first like seven seasons of The Next Generation prompts. And it was just like, what am I watching here? And so I had a lot of trouble. And I was a huge Star Trek fan. We all did. So I don't fault her ever for doing that. But I of course, she would have to like have some degree of regret. She came back.
She did. She came back, and we all loved Denise. But I think she regrets her choice. Yeah, but it's easy. It's easy to look back and have hindsight. It's very. I've made some mistakes as well.
What's a mistake you've made? What's something you regret?
Yeah, I regret. Oh, this is a major regret for me. So I started my career in San Diego.
Oh, okay.
At the Globe Theater.
Mm-hmm.
I was an apprentice there, and at that time, believe it or not, Jack O'Brien was not the artistic director. That's how many years ago this is. Craig Noll was, but Jack became a fan of mine, and I was a young boy who happened to move to New York and lived in an area about a block or two away from where Jack O'Brien lived. He lived in a better area of New York than I did, but we would pass on the street, and he was. And as I began to do, knock on wood, a lot of Broadway shows, he kept saying to me, "You owe us. You need." At this point, he was the artistic director. You need to come back. And the week after Deep Space Nine closed, Jack called me up and said, "I have a part for you in a play called The Hostage." And I said, "Oh, I've wanted to go back to the Globe all my life." Absolutely. And again, I had a conversation with my agents who said to me, "No, you've just come off two TV shows. You're free for the first time. You can't go off to San Diego and do a play. You have to be around for your next big job." And so I called Jack O'Brien. For those of you who don't know who Jack O'Brien is, there are probably no more than five living great, great, great theater directors. Just incredible directors. Jack O'Brien is one of those five directors.
He's amazing.
Yeah, he is amazing. And I called him up and said, "I can't do this." And I could hear the iron door in his voice closing. And as the gods would have it, during the 2 months that I would have been away in San Diego, not only did I not have a job, but nor did I have an audition. I could have gone away. Nobody would even known that I was missing. Mm-hmm. I could have done that production with Jack O'Brien and perhaps ingratiated myself a little bit more into Jack's good graces, which I had not been in since that phone call.
Wow. Okay. But he probably doesn't hold that against you.
No, he probably doesn't. But familiarity is how one gets a job in any one of the media. And so as the time went on that we didn't communicate, I'm sure lots of other people took my place in his estimation.
It's this little mental Rolodex. You're not the first one there. So,
and I always wanted to go back to the Globe. Even now, I've been thinking about writing the new artistic director at the Globe and saying, "You're about to do a Shakespeare Festival next summer. Would you consider me?" And I would go down and audition. Although the problem is, you living in San Diego know this. You can't audition in San Diego for the Globe. You have to go to New York City to audition for the Globe.
It is. There was a story of a very good actor in San Diego. For the longest time, you're right. You could, if you lived in San Diego, they would not see you. And this guy, I think his name is Sean Murray, maybe, really good actor in San Diego, was so frustrated in San Diego. He's like, "That's it. I'm moving to New York. I'm going to try my wares there." He moves out there. 2 weeks later, he gets an audition for the Globe. They're like, "God, you're great. Come over to San Diego." He goes back to San Diego, and that's the way to do it. Although it's changed now a little bit, because when they did the musical The Grinch, the composer or the writer stipulated, he says, "You have to see and cast some San Diego actors."
Really?
Yes. And my friend actually became the dog in it. And when they did, they're like, "Wow, there's some pretty good actors here." Like, we know, you know. So
yeah, there are wonderful actors. I worked a lot at The Rep, which is a sister theater company in San Diego. And I would hear these stories from the San Diego actors all the time.
Yeah, it was the, like, old Globe in La Jolla. Great theaters. You're never going to work there if you're in San Diego. Move to LA, move to New York.
The same thing happened with me with The Taper. I grew up, I went to college and high school in Los Angeles, and I couldn't get a job or an audition for The Taper. I went away to New York, luckily had a lot of good credits in New York and regional theater, came back, and that's when I could get a job at The Taper.
And in some ways, maybe that's okay, because you do have to sometimes go away in order to come back.
You do.
You have to go out to kind of put yourself on a limb in order to do these sorts of things. Kiernan has been watching the shows. So Kiernan, like as I said, I didn't push him into Star Trek. Not at all. And then we started watching The Orville. Have you watched The Orville?
No, not yet.
The Orville is TNG with Seth MacFarlane.
Mm-hmm.
It is 100% TNG. And it's great. And he started watching because it's very family friendly. There's one or two dick jokes per episode, and I think those are going away. And every once in a while we go, "Ugh." But and from that, he was like, "Dad, are there any Next Generation episodes that have like cool mysteries in them? It's like, oh, there are, buddy. So he got into Next Generation. Then he got into Deep Space Nine. Then he got into Voyager. And now he watches them all. And Kieran, what's your favorite franchise? What's your favorite series? Well, the answer
you put
is
him, you put him. You put him in a spot there.
I don't know. That's hard. I love all of them.
Okay. Oh, wow. Good for you.
Easy, honest. Yeah. So, Kieran, is there anything you want to ask Armin about Deep Space Nine, about acting, about anything?
Give me a second to think about that. That's so much.
Fair
so
enough.
Much.
All right. Fair enough. So, I'm sorry. Our bird, my cockatiel, is losing its mind. It's a very famous cockatiel, Armin. Last year, it was the most famous family member. It does the Apple iPhone ringtone.
Oh, really?
It has
6 million views. It has 6 million views on YouTube. So last year, as I'm still going through my midlife crisis, I turn on YouTube and it's the number one trending video. It's more famous than I am. It's so depressing.
That's exasperating.
Okay. I think I have some.
My foot was in the shot, though. You could see my foot.
So Kieran has a question.
Oh, you got a question. Okay, great.
What was your favorite moment on Deep Space Nine?
Getting hired.
That
would be my favorite moment. As far as performance, there's a speech in an episode called The Siege of AR something, something, something.
Siege of AR-15, right?
I think it's more than 15.
558, I think.
Yeah,
I
can't remember.
Yeah.
And it's where the writers allowed me to say something Spock-like in reference to the humans.
Yeah.
And
we just watched that.
That
yeah.
was one of my
yeah.
favorite moments. But there are lots, Kieran, there are lots and lots of wonderful memories. A lot of my work with Rom, with Max Grudenchek, is very dear to me. There are a lot of actors. Aaron Eisenberg, Jeffrey Combs, Terry Farrell, an unknown actor named Rene Aubergenois. all those moments are delicious to me. But that was one of the great speeches for me. I like that a great deal.
That's a great one. And you killed someone in that one. Was that the first time you killed anyone?
Yeah. Yeah. Ferengi don't kill.
That's because I one of my favorites, and I think I told you this 18 years ago, is when you dress down Sisko and saying, Ferengi have never had wars. We've never had slavery. Yeah. We've never had any of this sort of stuff. And it was such a great, I think it was like first season because he still had hair. It was such a great flip of...
It was a Spock moment.
It was a Spock moment. And it was, I think Star Trek VI also had a moment right around that time where the Klingons are saying the Federation is a humans only kind of thing. And it really kind of opened me up. It's like, wow, maybe humans in the Federation aren't
perfect.
You know, perfect.
Yeah, they're not. They're not.
Yeah.
They're not. And at least on our show, we tried to show that. We tried to show that the humans weren't perfect, and that all the races had their fortes and their vices and their. So our writing staff was very good about being well rounded to all the species, and in that way, would make humanity look at itself and say we're not perfect and we can do better. And that's the whole point of Star Trek is hope that we can be better.
Well, that's what it should be. Sometimes it's not.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's not, but and I'm I have various opinions on some of the other. Anyway, we'll talk about that afterwards. Let me see. I have a couple of questions from some of the fans.
Sure,
if you don't mind me open them. Although I do have to say one thing. Have you ever seen the documentary The Captains?
No.
Okay, so you haven't seen. Are you saying that diplomatically?
Yes. Because,
okay. Because I know you've seen it. I know.
No,
I've
not seen it.
You've not seen Shatner talk to Avery Brooks?
No. Okay. No, I can't imagine what that conversation would be like.
I know you're lying. You know, it's fine. It's all right. And if not, I'm going to show it to you. Because
okay, you can show it to me. But no, the truth is, and I tend to tell the truth. My counterpart, Quark, doesn't, but I do. I've never seen it. I've never had a desire to see it.
I have to show you.
Like, I know those people. So what do I have to listen to them for? I've met them all, some more than others. Certainly Avery and Scott. Scott was an old friend of mine.
Long before
Star Trek. I'll probably see him this Christmas. Avery, Kate, those are friends of mine. I've met Shatner a handful of times. I don't know.
But has he met you?
No, probably not.
Yes, exactly. No. And then the captains, you have this immovable force and this unthinking object coming together, and it's magic. I can say these things. You don't have to. Let me ask this, though. What was your lowest moment on in the show? What was a moment where you were really like, oh?
Yeah. It was an episode. Well, certainly moments, if we just talk about moments, sometimes when the days got to be 19, 20 hours in makeup, those were low moments. Or the time that, or the times that I was sick and still had to perform.
Yeah.
So my head is all stuffed up and I'm inside a head. I remember one shot once where they said, okay, that's a take. And I went, a take? I don't even remember shooting that. And I had been asleep. They had been shooting over my shoulder. And I guess they just didn't wake me up. But as far as episodes go, there's no doubt in my mind. The episode that is the most repulsive to me, and the one that I regret that we ever shot, was called Profit and Lace, where they decided it'd be a great joke to make Quark a woman. I don't mind playing women. I played women on stage several times. That's a great opportunity. But the problem was that my character didn't learn anything from being a woman, and it was just a joke. We want to see Quark and drag.
And that's been like called out as been like one of the worst episodes of Deep Space. I don't remember that one watching.
Good. You shouldn't watch it more than once. And...
Have you seen? Yeah, I know. Yeah. We don't have to see that. That's fine. Have you seen that one, Kieran, or no?
No, I actually haven't. I just looked it up.
Do yourself a favor. Leave it for last.
You can skip over that one. That one's fine. There's because that show, what season was that? That was later season.
Six.
Yeah.
Six.
Was it six?
Six sounds right.
So they're kind of like, you know, I mean, Serialized is great, but feeding a beast of 22 episodes a season is
26.
Difficult. 26, yeah. So 26 a season is insane.
Yeah, because the normal is 22.
Right.
And we did 26.
Yeah.
And we did it in makeup, and we did it, we had a little bit of a break between May and late July. And then we went back in, and it was lovely while we were doing it. They were long days. My average day was about 16, 17 hours. And that was day after day after day. And on Big Ferengi episode, so that's every day for 8 days. And my own, a hell of my own making, when I wasn't shooting Star Trek, I was probably shooting Buffy. And if I wasn't shooting Buffy, I was probably shooting something else. And the studio and my producers were enormously kind and lenient about letting me go off to do other shows, which my contract said was verboten. I couldn't do that.
Oh, really? Interesting. Yeah. I think I shot one commercial during The Invisible Man, the only time I've been a series regular, and they gave me so much grief on that.
Yeah.
Like, who cares, man? I'm only doing like 1 day a week, you know? Yeah. Like, well, we'll have to clear it with a network. Like, the network, but I mean, you know.
Yeah. Anyway. Well, they let me go. God knows how many shows I shot while shooting Star Trek. And, I sort of told my friends on Voyager they should do the same thing, and it turned out that their line producer didn't allow them to do what my line producer had allowed me to do.
Oh, okay. So you got a little more, you know.
Yeah. And it may be, again, because, I don't know, you'd have to ask Steve Oster who made that decision, but I think it's because we rotated. As I said, each one of us got our own show every 8 episodes. So a lot of times I was just there for my residual scene, which allowed me to get a residual.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had the rest of the week off. So they said, go off and do what you have to do.
That's great.
And perhaps on the other shows, you know, certainly Picardo, I remember telling this too, he was in a lot of episodes of, as you say, might have been the focus for Voyager. Neelix was sort of in my shoes, but even he, they wouldn't let go. So.
Mm, wow, okay. Interesting. Kieran, do you have any follow-up or no? You don't have to.
No. Do you watch a lot of the other Star Trek shows?
No.
Oh, you don't?
No. Okay. I watched the first... Oh, sorry, Scott. I watched the first episode of Enterprise, and went, okay, and I've watched, and I've got a lot of friends on Voyager. I've watched maybe about 4 or 5 episodes of Voyager, and I have not seen an episode of Deep Space Nine since we stopped shooting.
Okay, and you haven't seen Discovery at all?
I've seen the first episode of Discovery, I just said, why should I pay for to watch Star Trek? So no, I haven't seen any but the first episode of Discovery.
How is like CBS All Access not granted you some sort of golden card to like,
how not?
Swipe in your computer?
Worse than that, Michael, and or it's not worse. It's just the nature of things. It really is the nature of things. So I'm not complaining at all. But there was a time when I was working there for 7 years that I had the run of the lot. I could park any time, anywhere I wanted to. The guards all waved me through. The guards all knew me by my first name. I knew them by their first name. And as the years have gone by since then, the guards have all matriculated, and nobody knows who I am anymore. And I have to go through that process of, you know, getting through security, which is what you have to do in order for them to be safe. I understand all that. It's just the juxtaposition of what was once and what is now is a little bit saddened, but certainly is the nature of life. You know, that's how life passes.
Yeah, that bummed me out, man. Because you're right. I mean, there are moments in our lives we can't go back, and even when we do, it's different, isn't it?
Like, it is different. Yeah.
The guards don't know who you are, and even right. If you went back,
I remember for years, or at least for months anyway, Quark's character hung from the huge, several stories high, hung from the side of the Paramount Building in New York City, and it was just a big, big poster of Quark.
Oh, wow.
And even while that was hanging there, you know, the guards didn't recognize me at Paramount.
I'm that guy.
So it's just one of the interesting dichotomies of life. And you just have to say, it's a life experience. Learn from this.
Yeah. But don't live there.
No, don't live there. You can't live in the past. Despite the flattering things that we're talking about now and your interest in me and people who are listening's interest, for which I'm enormously flattered. But that was a period of my life I'm very proud of, happy to revisit, but it's past, it's gone.
That is actually the pilot of Deep Space Nine. I mean, if you remember, it's where like Sisko lived, like the wormhole aliens, like, why do you live here? I always think about that moment where like, cause he's living in these moments of his life. And we tend to do that sometimes. It's like, oh, I still lament the Invisible Man being canceled. You still think about being able to like, hey, Joe, let me into the lot, you know, but we can't live there. We have to move forward.
You have to move forward. And you have to accept what life has given you now. Enjoy it. Appreciate it. I'm of an age where a lot of my friends have passed away. I've learned from them and from other people and all the reading I've done. You must enjoy what's given to you now and appreciate it. The glass is always, always half full.
That's wonderful. That's amazing. We should stop there, but
if you want to continue on, you can put it into the next episode if you want.
Yeah, I'm just going to put it in my iPod and listen to it forever and ever, man. That's so inspiring. But I promised some of these people I would ask a couple questions.
Sure, good.
So, but that's great. That's great. See, like that's why I'm here, is to hear people smarter than me, more successful than me, dispense knowledge upon me, which helps me in my life. And my eventual death, I guess. All right, so I got dark.
You can never be dead because the work that you did on camera will live after you.
Oh, I love that. I love that. But by that token, I mean, isn't there, like, that's also part of the problem with theater, too, and yes. In improv as well.
Yes. But yes, there's no videotape. There's no digital, reminder of that. But if you have done a phenomenal performance on stage in a place where people can see it, even if there's got to be some audience. If you've moved somebody in the audience, mm-hmm. and they remember that performance for the rest of their lives, that's as good as being on videotape. That's as good as being on digital. It lives in their memory. And if it's iconographic enough, that person tells somebody who didn't see it, and they say, "Oh, I remember when somebody told me about such and such." So you have life after death there too. That's what I teach my students. You know, they have to look up the actors who've been dead for centuries and tell me about them and tell me what they did.
Yeah.
So that they don't live in just the moment. They see the journey of our career from medieval plays to current plays in New York or Los Angeles or any place else.
That's great. I used to teach at AMDA in Hollywood, mm-hmm. and it's right on the Hollywood Way with all the stars, and you don't recognize like 2/3 of those people. And I would always tell my students, like, if you want extra credit, find one of those stars you don't know, come back and tell me about it.
Great, that's great.
Because I mean, some of them are just like, and even me, I'm like, who is that? You look it up, and it's just, and then they live again.
They live again.
It's so wonderful. All right, let me ask this. All right, so Christopher asks, what did you use as inspiration to build your character? You did a great job as the seasons went on, I guess presuming that you were bad in the beginning. No, I'm kidding. So what was your inspiration?
Well, what was my originally, my inspiration was just greed. I wanted to be on the show. But if I had to point to anything, and I've said this several times before, I have a friend. His name is Frank Kopek. He lives pretty close to here, actually. Yeah. And I would say to myself, well, what would Frank do here? And Frank was my inspiration for Quark often. But as you understand, Michael, many times we just draw from our own life experiences. Mm-hmm. So it's not like I'm trying to copy anyone. I'm trying to say, how do I feel about this? But if I'm really bedeviled by what to do here, then I might say to myself, what would Frank do here? And so that would be helpful. But basically, it's my life with some help from Frank Kopek.
Does Frank know that?
Yes, he does.
Okay.
Yeah, he knows.
That's cool. That's cool. And the character I played on The Invisible Man, I borrowed from my friend Scott.
Yeah.
So there's a very, yeah. So that's, but yeah, that's good. Okay. Question for him. How does he see, this is from Jim. How does he see Deep Space Nine compare to the original series and Next Generation? Do you think the stories were better, worse, or the same?
Good. The stories are better. We are the premier Star Trek show that ever aired.
Good,
now,
good.
I can understand where I'm coming from, but I really do believe that. And I believe that because some of the things I've said, we had an exceptional cast, mm-hmm. And more importantly, we had exceptional writer's room. Those guys, led by Ira Bear, oh my God, this is terrible. This is a senior moment.
Who are some other writers?
No.
I
got to
get some more.
Okay.
Michael Piller.
Here, Karen.
Michael Piller, who was the originator with Rick Berman of the show.
Mm-hmm.
Michael, who unfortunately passed away and was replaced by Ira Bear as the showrunner. Those guys' imagination, those guys' wit, those guys' bravery, all made us, in my mind, the premier Star Trek show. And as the years have gone by, I think we've also proved to be the most, we've held our ground probably better than any other show, simply again because of the format of serialization as opposed to episodic shows.
I agree with that. I think the show matured and stuck the landing of the last season better than probably any of the other series, I would say. I mean the first couple seasons were kind of rough, as most of the shows are. But then you guys found your footing from a narrative standpoint. You know, the serialization became stronger, the characters became stronger, and then the last couple of seasons were so so strong and so emotionally rewarding.
And that is absolutely true. That's credit to our writers, credit to our actors, but especially a credit to our recurring characters,
mm-hmm.
who made up the Dominion War. And as I said earlier, those guys could be on the show all by themselves and carry the show. We had phenomenal guest stars.
Oh, gosh. I mean, so much. I mean, you know, you have... You know.
And that's a credit to Ron Cirma and Junie Lowry, who were the casting directors, who brought those people in.
Yeah, fabulous. Yeah, probably the best guest stars out of all the series, hands down. Easily. Because you're right. From basically seasons 5 through 7, a lot of the guest stars carried a lot of the show. So, I mean, there were some scenes where you had Gul Dukat and Kai Winn just doing their own thing. And they're not series regulars. They're just like, right. They have their own subplots. It's like, we're not checking in with anybody. So,
yeah. But Louise Fletcher, who's an old friend of mine, called me up when she was cast and said, so tell me about the makeup. Is this going to be a problem? And I said, oh, Louise, it's just a little tiny rubber nose on your nose. It's not going to be a problem at all. Then what I didn't know, because I was Quark, they gave her 2 hours of hair, which she was not very happy with. But so she complained to me later on about, you didn't tell me about the hair. I said, Louise, I didn't know anything about the hair department.
Didn't she wear a hat?
She wore a little hat on top of a huge wig. Huge, a very hot and cumbersome wig.
Oh, gosh. Oh, well, I'm sorry about that. But she was great.
Yes, she is. Fabulous. She's a lovely lady.
Okay, this is a good one. Would all right? Would Quark have voted for Donald Trump?
Every Quark. Fiber of my being would say no, but I can't answer that question. I know Armin certainly wouldn't, and I started the Trek Against Trump campaign. So,
oh wow,
we were against Trump even before he was elected. But would Quark vote for Trump? I'll have to let the listeners decide.
Okay, fair enough. I would say probably yes. I would say, I'll answer that for you, and I'll say probably yes, because on the surface, he's such a business-oriented...
Yeah, they have a lot in common, but there are things that I think even Quark couldn't stomach.
All right, we will leave that at that, so it's... but. I didn't know you started the Trek Against Trump. See, now you're informing me. This is fascinating. All right. Let's see. Ken Somez says, this is a long one. I'd be interested in hearing more about his thoughts on the high proportion of DS9 actors with a strong theatrical background. We talked about that. He's one of several who have gone to teach acting in theater. God, was she reading her minds here? In the academic setting... Andrew Robinson.
He was the dean of USC. Not the dean. He told me recently he wasn't the dean. He was one of the head teachers for the graduate students at USC. He just recently retired from that position.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
USC is University of Southern California, by the way.
Yes. So they say, is there something specific about sci-fi that has crossover with theater?
Yes, there is. At least classical theater. With classical theater and with sci-fi, you're dealing with worldly events. You're not dealing with the mundane. You're not dealing with, personal peccadilloes. You're dealing with world issues. And classical theater, and often modern theater for that matter as well, deals with that. So there is that connection. And both science fiction... I'm not saying all, Star Trek, and I'm not saying all science fiction, but Star Trek has a unique and iconographic language. We call it technobabble. And in order to be able to make that stuff sound real, you need the ability to be good with language. And a classical actor... who is used to saying words that aren't familiar to himself or to his audience, learns those techniques. And so I believe that's why Junie and Ron would tend to use classical actors, because they could trust that we would be able to handle the technobabble.
I would agree with that. It is, I'm sure as Kieran, and as I went into, I'm using myself a lot as a reference.
Good, that's good. Right? Why shouldn't you?
I'm catching myself saying, am I trying to equate myself with Armin? And that's not it. But every time you talk about something, it brings something forth for me. But in saying that, when I first tackled Shakespeare, I had no idea what the hell I was saying. I was so confused. And I have to imagine on the other end, like when someone's trying to do all the Star Trek techno babble, if you're not well versed in it, like a Tetrion pulse is just as strange as, what is it, honorificale billy tutinat and tibus? Did I say it correct?
Close enough, yeah. From Love's Labor's Lost. I won't do it for you, but yes, close enough.
No, because I played that part, and I had no idea what I was doing in that. I was like a sophomore in college, mm-hmm. And I was like, what am I doing? I talked to the director, and he's like, you're doing fine. I'm like, all right, fair enough. So how would you say that?
I can't remember the words, so I won't even. I know the words from Les Labor's Lost. I've done the play twice, including at the Globe. But I don't remember exactly how to say it. But I don't remember being said just that way.
Maybe I'm right.
Maybe you're right.
Maybe my deep Ozark, affiliations.
Well, remember, if you're from the Ozarks, that's the sound. That's the Shakespearean sound.
I've watched 2 seasons of Ozark, so I feel pretty close. I feel pretty close to the. Have you watched Ozark?
No. Sorry. I watch very little TV.
You're okay. You're okay. I'm going to save you from that. So.
Okay.
That one's not so good. All right. Well, I think we've kind of. Oh, what? One more. Zach Cotty has said, I just want to know him to know that when Quark does the Picard speech from First Contact in the Dogs of War, it was my favorite thing ever.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah, that was a lovely speech too. The Dogs of War is the penultimate episode of Deep Space Nine. And in that episode, I had been complaining to the writers, all the other series regulars, and a lot of the recurring characters had matriculated. They'd gone from one thing and become something else.
Yeah.
And I went to the writers long before that episode and said, what's happened to Quark? Quark hasn't changed one iota. Mm-hmm. And when I did Dogs of War, from which that speech is indicative of, I realized, reading that episode before we ever acted it, but reading the script, I went, oh, that's how he's changed. And then I could look back and go, yeah, he's changed. Not as dramatically as Bashir, not as dramatically as Kira, certainly not as dramatically as Sisko, or even Odo, but enough subtly to yes, I could see what the change was.
And it's funny you say that. I mean, because in some ways there is almost a comfort in the fact that Quark is who he is. Like that's what, like I was trying to say earlier on, in that like Quark's arc is almost the stability of the fact that the Cardassians were here and left, the Federation was sort of here and left, and now it's sort of the Bajorans. But Quark is that constant. He is that bartender shining the glass and saying, you know, here I am. Right. To a degree. But did he sell the bar at the end or no?
No, the bar is still there. If they were to bring back Deep Space Nine, I'd still be behind the bar. And we lived for a long time, longer than humans, so I could still be there. In fact, I put on the makeup for the first time.
I was going to say.
In 18 years, a couple of weeks ago. And when Karen was finished, my makeup lady from Deep Space Nine.
Oh, so you got the original one.
Yeah, it was part of my deal. I said, I won't even think about doing this unless Karen, because I'm just the canvas. She's the artist.
Yeah.
And when I was done, I was gobsmacked at seeing myself in the mirror. And in fact, Ira, who was there, a lot of the series regulars were there. They were equally as gobsmacked. They said, you look identical.
You look the same.
I thought that was like a picture from back then. Yeah.
Except for the teeth. The teeth were a replacement, and they weren't the same. But the face. I had the experience that no one will ever have. I got into a time machine and went back in time.
Yeah.
I went, that's me 20 years ago.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, Karen's work was exquisite, and she covered up all the changes in my face. It's not just my hair color. It's just my face has wrinkles. My face has lines that it didn't have 20 years ago. But all of those were gone, and I looked exactly the way I looked 20 years ago.
I saw that picture. We'll post it on – we have a Facebook page. I'll post that for anyone to check it out. It was amazing. And aside from Aaron, like, growing taller, like –
He didn't actually. He hasn't. Ciroc has grown taller.
Ciroc is
now the largest actor on our show. Tallest, anyway. Aaron has a kidney condition, so he's always been the same height, always.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah. Okay. My friends know him. He's a wedding photographer.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think he took my friend's wedding pictures, actually.
He's very good at it. Yeah.
Is it? Yeah. My friend who plays Nog.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
He lives around here, yeah.
Really?
Not quite.
Oh, no, he doesn't anymore? Okay.
No, he never did.
Oh, he didn't?
No.
Well, then where was he?
He lives in L.A., but not anywhere around here.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm speaking like the general L.A.
He lives in L.A., yes.
Yes, okay. Fair enough.
Okay. Or outside of L.A., yeah.
Okay. Right. That feels very mysterious. I no, like
but
that.
So, I don't want to give away where people live, but he doesn't live in L.A. And he has his own Star Trek blog, by the way.
Oh, he does?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah, right. He does,
we should have him on the show.
Yeah, you know? He'd love to do that.
Huh. I mean, this is... See, no. So was this... Like part of my fear... Like having people like yourself of your ilk, although you're certainly probably, I think you're the first series regular I've had on the show. But we had Robert O'Reilly and we had Ellen Geer and we've had.
Robert O'Reilly?
Yeah.
Garrick.
Gowron.
Guy Gowron.
Gowron, yeah. Gowron.
And Bob and I met doing plays.
We did
plays long before we did Star Trek.
Yeah, he's great. He was great. Yeah, we talked about our eye size because we both have really big eyes. But my fear is always that this becomes this weird kind of like spiral into Star Trek. When instead, I'm more interested in talking to you guys. Like, I like talking about Star Trek, but when I talk to you guys, I want to know about like everything around it. And so hopefully this has been Star Trek adjacent for you. And so we can talk about other stuff, which also interests you. So.
I've talked about my teaching, which does interest me. I'm also a writer. I've written a couple novels.
Yes.
I was a union official for many years. Probably, yes, when we were working, I was a union official. I help administer the theater that we help run, which is Antillas in Glendale, which is a classically based theater company. We have several Star Trek actors as members of our company, Linda Park being the primary one from... Enterprise,
yeah, she's...
And we have
Yoshi.
A lot of other...
Yoshi.
Okay. And so there, I have... One of the things that, if you want to learn at all from me, Michael, and I'm sure you've already done this, any actor, and I don't care who the actor is, top to bottom, you have to find other things to do. You have to find other interests that keep your mind busy, your passions busy. And so I have found many outlets besides acting to keep my mind busy. And of course, as you asked me before, I have no children, so I have a lot more free time than most. And I think if I have any sanity at all, it's because I've allowed myself to pursue other avenues that have little to do with acting. It's not that acting isn't all-consuming. It can be, but if it becomes all-consuming... then the downtimes become rather depressing because you have nothing else to fill it up with.
Yeah.
And so when I've had downtimes, I do other things and don't realize that I haven't had an audition in 6 months, you know?
I get that. That's why I'm here. That's 2 years, 2.5 years ago, I was kind of cycling out of acting and it's like, maybe I'm just going to go do this for a while. So
yeah. And there's nothing wrong. I have great admiration. I'm not talking about you, but lots of other friends who have cycled out and taken on other occupations. And, you know, I have, because I know how difficult that must be, because I faced that at 40. At 40, I was prepared to cycle out. This is long before we met. And I was absolutely ready to do something else. And lucky for me, nothing cropped up. And it wasn't Star Trek that brought me out of that depression or that decision, but rather a show called Brooklyn Bridge that cropped up out of nowhere, which that had never happened in my career before. And I became a recurring character on that. And that sort of bucked me up. And while I was doing that, I had the audition for Star Trek. So,
wow, that's great. So, and then from there?
Star Trek... is an enormous crutch, both financially and artistically. So the financial crutch from Star Trek was enough to keep me from ever thinking about doing anything else. And there were, for at least 7 to 10 years after Star Trek, I did enough guest star work so that was, satisfying and financially stabilizing. After that, things pretty much slowed down, and then my interest in other things really took over.
what's one interest that we don't know about that, I mean, that you're comfortable in talking about?
Sure. Again, I help run, in a small way, a theater in Glendale called Antaeus.
Were they on Lancashire at one point?
They were. We were growing mightily. And we didn't have enough space in Lancashire anymore, so we moved to Glendale. My wife, God bless her, raised $5 million to move us to Glendale and to take an empty space and turn it into two theaters and a library and teaching space. And we're very proud of that. Chris Pine, again, was a student in Lancashire for our academy. So right now that and the teaching are the two things that fill up most of my time. And I start a play next week at the Geffen. I used to keep my hand in the theater. And I would be doing a two-hander with Brian Dennehy called Huey by Eugene O'Neill. And I'll play that into December. But I finished a play recently at Antaeus, a wonderful play called 3 Days in the Country. Had a great time doing that. I tend to look more for theater work than for TV work for the reasons I explained earlier.
Sure.
And also, to be honest and frank with you, TV isn't interested in me anymore. They have either decided that that they know what my work is and they want something new, and they're entitled to that.
Sure.
Or I've just outgrown all the parts.
TV is about the shiny, flashy new
thing,
isn't it?
That's right. And you know what? One time we were that.
One time we were that.
And we should celebrate. Glasses half full. We took advantage of that when it was our turn, and we did, you know, we benefited from that. And now it's somebody else's turn. And I really understand that. And if I want to continue working as an actor, then I look for it in the theater, or I look for it in my own theater, which I rarely act in my own theater. But I do work at other places, and that satisfies that urge, that itch. And plus the other things really take up a lot of my time, and I'm really grateful for them.
I agree with that. I agree with that. If you find something else, other things start opening up for you. That's always been like my mantra. Just do something else that you love, and then something good things come to you.
So, absolutely. I told you about Alan Gear. So it was 30 years of teaching, and then the USC came out of that. And it's after 28 years of teaching, USC had heard about my reputation and just said, take the job if you want it.
Who's the head of acting at...
The dean there is David Bridell. He was the guy who, I guess, eventually had the responsibility for teaching me. But certainly Mary Jo Negro was my advocate to him. So
I know David Bridell. He taught me at Cal State Long Beach. Mm.
So he's the dean there now.
Yeah.
And for the Department of Theater.
He's great. He's really great. So, well, now we're starting to divest here in other stories here. So why don't we put a cap on this? Armin, this is so great to like kind of revisit you and revisit all of these moments of my life and your life in this, you know, like this 18-year hiatus we took from seeing each other. And I had a kid in the interim. So it's been so great to have you. And what interesting kismet that I'm writing on a series and the actor is managed by Lisa, and she just happened to mention, oh, well, I represent Armin. I was like, oh my God, I got it, you know. And so I pressed her hard on it, and so you said yes.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. Once she mentioned it to me, I remember you fondly from those conversations and the work that we did together. So, I said, fine, whenever Michael wants to do it, I'm happy to do it. I don't like necessarily doing these things. I'm having a great time today, but I don't like, and here's why I don't. It's been a lot of these stories I've told ad infinitum, and so I'm a little bored with myself. I'm bored with telling the same story over and over and over again. Most of the stuff I've said today, I really haven't said that often.
Good.
And that's because of you, Michael. You've prompted me to say things that I don't normally are de rigueur for me. So that's great. And Lisa said to me, I know you don't like to do these. Is it okay? I said, absolutely. I remember Michael fondly. Yeah, let's do this.
See, again, the nicest guy. And you still deep in my memory, and you've honored me with that last statement. So we have to stop now, because that's You can't say anything nicer, I don't think.
No, but I can ask you to, you should put me on your cartoon show.
Oh, I will. Oh, absolutely. Yes. We went on, I'll tell you afterwards, because
okay,
the season isn't out, but I mean, that and beyond, for sure, for sure.
Because as I said, I love doing voiceovers, because as I said, there's no work. It's just fun.
I know. I'll tell you more about that afterwards, because the season isn't out yet, but it's going to be pretty amazing.
Good.
Yeah.
So congratulations on that, Michael.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much, Armin, for coming on, and I'd love to have you back some other time if you want to tell
us. Whenever you want.
Yeah, it's
you know, maybe Kieran could do the interviewing and get questions from him.
That would be more of a deep dive into the series, because I haven't watched it as much. And he's like, Dad, have you watched episode, you know, this on season three? He's like, what's it about? It's like, Cisco does something, this thing. I don't know, maybe. Yeah. You know, it's been like
25 years. To help me too, because it's a long time ago. As I said, I haven't watched the show since we stopped shooting it.
Yeah, it's
done with it.
Oh, good for you, great. How many? I think it's 173 episodes.
176.
176.
How many have you watched? He has a list. Tell me that he's watched them all. Watched all the series.
Well, almost. Yeah, I have a percentage list of how much I've watched it, just to, because there's, I think that there's like 700 episodes all in all.
Like almost 800 now.
I think I'm at 65%.
Wow.
For DS9, and that's like at least like 120 episodes. I'm 29% on Enterprise. I still have to push through that. Next Generation, I'm at like 45%, and in Voyager.
Oh, I'm flattered. Flattered. Yeah.
Oh yeah, and Voyager, I'm at 60, just because DS9 was so different from all of them.
Mm-hmm.
I watched all of them. I'm almost done. So
good, good, good.
On the way
home,
have
a good time.
Yeah, on the way home from Loxa, because it's an hour and a half drive. He drives. We watched. What was the last episode? What You Take With You. Is that what it's called?
What You Leave Behind.
What You Leave Behind. Yeah,
that's our last episode.
Yeah, we watched that. So, well, you have left behind, I'm trying to phrase this, so much for me, and thank you for being on this.
Oh, my pleasure. Moment. Thank you.
And on behalf of, I'm Mike McCafferty.
I'm Kieran McCafferty.
Armin Shimmerman.
And I just want to talk about
Star Trek.
Error, law, imperfection.
When the train comes in, everybody rides.
Blah, 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 blah.
No